I don't think it's as friendly as both of them say. You know, when that subway safety plan was announced, the mayor was not standing next to the governor. And when asked about it, the governor spent about 5 minutes saying that it's no big deal that the mayor was not there.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, we welcome back one of New York's most astute political minds, Errol Lewis. Last time we spoke with Errol, a Spectrum anchor and contributor to New York Magazine, it was about a special podcast project on former Governor Mario Cuomo. Now, for this pivotal and bruising election year, Lewis has launched a new national political show, The Big Deal. And it comes as budget making in Albany heats up and the presidential rematch nears. Errol, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Ian. Thanks so much.
So I think we're both probably in a political media bubble to a degree. Let me ask you this. All I hear about from polls is how unplugged people are from politics this year and dissatisfied with the choices in front of them. Do you think that's really true?
I think it's a little bit more complicated. Here's what I believe is going on. There's a difference between a preference and a choice. So I think we're at the preference stage where the polls are mostly trying to register people's preference. And if you ask people's preference, they'll say, I'd rather have a brand new candidate who's honest and effective and can bring the country together and so forth and so on. I would compare that to wanting to have a steak dinner when you're going to your cousin's wedding. The problem, of course, is that when you get to that wedding, the choice is actually chicken or fish, right? So we can talk all we want about all the steak that we would prefer to have, but the reality is when November rolls around, the choices are going to be chicken or fish, just like the last time.
What kind of role do you see New York playing in this upcoming election? Because obviously on the presidential side, you know, it would be shocking if Biden didn't carry the state, but the House races are another story.
Yeah, the House races are another story. Given the tightness of the margin of control between the Republicans and the Democrats, there are a number of states, New York happens to be one, where true swing districts, truly competitive races, could in fact tip control of the House to one party or the other. And that's true in California, by the way, where there's something like 10 seats that have been targeted. Definitely true in New York, are arguably true in other states, like I think Texas has a number of competitive races. So every vote will count. Every race will count. And in New York, I think there's good reason to believe that there's something like four or five so-called Biden districts, meaning districts that Joe Biden won 4 years ago, that are currently represented by Republicans. That all by itself tells you that there's something going on, and Democrats are going to try and exploit whatever ambivalence or imbalances might appear to be there and see if they can win those districts, take them back, and win control of the House. Absolutely.
An interesting Albany thing happened with the latest iteration of the new maps for these House races, which was the Independent Commission put forward its plan. And then there were a few days of, you know, people getting a chance to weigh in on it and read tea leaves and try to understand what the Democratic Party statement meant. And then we got maps drawn by the lawmakers in the end anyway, although I think it's fair to say they were seen as potentially less gerrymandered than the last time around, which led to the court case, which led to the maps being redrawn anyway this time. How do you see the new congressional maps? I mean, do they seem fair to you, fairer?
The new congressional maps are very close to the old congressional maps, and they have a number of what I would call fair fight districts where, like, you know, New York 1, New York 3, some of the races in the Hudson Valley, District 17, District 19, where the lines were drawn by a special master a couple of years ago from outside New York State and presumably outside of the thick of New York politics to try and create some districts where Republicans would have a fair shot in what is an otherwise very blue, very Democratic state. The Democrats did not want to roll the dice by tampering with those lines to a great extent, and therefore they avoided a court case. They avoided having it put back in the hands of a special master, and they've got a bunch of fair fight districts. They did not press their advantage because the reality is, as far as I can tell, legally they would have been within their rights to do a very partisan, very aggressive gerrymander, and they just chose not to. I think probably they wanted to avoid another trip to court.
What's your read on the Democratic primary in the Jamal Bowman, George Latimer race?
Oh, that's interesting. An interesting question, too, because I grew up in Westchester, in New Rochelle. And so I have a lot of relatives that are in that district, and they're watching this all very closely. I think what is going on there, and it's pretty straightforward, actually, is that Jamal Bowman went out of his way, I think, to make a statement against the current policy in the Middle East in ways that upset a lot of the Jewish constituents in Westchester in particular, in that district. They made no bones about it. The American Israel Political Action Committee, APAC, made no bones about it. They let it be known that they were interested in funding a challenger to Jamal Bowman, and that's when George Latimer stepped forward and said, I'll do it. I don't think it's that much more complicated, to tell you the truth. Now, both candidates deny that that's the only issue. They say, well, there's other things that are going on, and he's a distraction, and he's not doing this, and he's not doing that. You say the things that you have to if you want to fire a congressman. It's usually not about one thing. It's usually about a lot of things. But in this case, I think that's the starting point of this candidacy. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. One thing, Ian, that I thought is really interesting, to the extent that people are running on the proposition that Middle East policy has to change and that we need a ceasefire and so forth and so on, I've been asking a number of people, what happens if there is a ceasefire? That could happen tomorrow. You know, what if they do find or release the hostages or negotiate a release? Mm-hmm. What if that happens in July? What if that happens in August? Does that go away as an issue? Does George Latimer then have nothing else to run on? Like, what does all of this mean? I think that's an open question that I'm very, very curious about.
Yeah. And as we're speaking, you know, Senator Schumer is already calling for kind of a post Netanyahu future to take effect. So, yeah, it could be a very different playing field in just a little while. Mm-hmm. You know, what was interesting? George Latimer was on our Congressional Corner series, and it was the same day that Elliot Engel's endorsement of Latimer's campaign was announced. And in that interview, Latimer was complaining that Bowman doesn't show up in the district. And he's heard from people, local representatives, that, you know, they don't have a lot of face time with Representative Bowman, which was effectively the thing that cost Engel his job at the end.
Oh, that's an interesting charge. I mean, look, it always comes up. You know, you got to keep in mind, maybe I'm a little bit, I don't want to be too cynical about this, but when you have a primary race of this kind, it's not there are no fundamentally different philosophies that are being contested here. You know, it's not like one wants to raise taxes and the other wants to lower taxes. They probably both want to raise taxes. It's not like one wants to tax the rich and the other one doesn't. They both probably want to tax the rich. There's not a, you know, and in these cases, people start resorting to, you know, I guess you would call lesser complaints, like, oh, he didn't show up at enough meetings. It's a very easy charge to make and an almost impossible charge to refute. In a district where, what's the size of a congressional district? About 750,000 people. Nobody's going to be at every ribbon cutting, every school graduation, every county fair. It's just not going to happen. And so it's an easy charge to make, like I said, impossible to refute. I'm not sure that's going to move people to the polls one way or the other.
So you've given me a good segue to talk about President Biden for a minute. I mentioned your new show, The Big Deal, and I watched your State of the Union episode. So many people in our coverage area, you know, New York Democrats, are counting on President Biden performing well in November because we know that a presidential race, you know, has long coattails. How did you think the president did in answering the questions about his ability to kind of be presidential?
Oh, well, I think he answered that question in a way that he almost could not have failed. The Republicans, I believe, went overboard in acting as if he was so debilitated, so out of it, so incapable, that all he had to do was get to the podium and not drool on himself, and he would have exceeded the expectations. And so anybody who watched the speech saw a man who was able to deliver a speech. You know, that doesn't doesn't speak to his ultimate questions of, you know, stamina or endurance or, you know, mental acuity or anything like that. But again, if you listened to what was being said on right-wing radio or on Fox News or what his opponents were saying, they made it sound as if he couldn't do anything. And of course he could get up and give a speech. I mean, he's, you know, he was elected to the Senate in 1972. He was more at home in that chamber than probably everybody except the guy who sweeps the floor, you know? And so you weren't going to catch him off guard in that setting, I don't think. And indeed they did not. And I thought he did fine. I mean, that question to me was answered definitively, at least for that night. You know, it'll come back up as an issue because the whole world wasn't watching that one speech. But I think Republicans or opponents of the president who were hoping that he would embarrass himself or show that he's not up to the job based on that speech, I think they were badly outmaneuvered and completely disappointed.
So do you think that New York Republicans are driven by fierce loyalty and devotion to Trump? I'm talking about voters and voters supporting kind of MAGA candidates the way that they are in other parts of the country?
No, I don't think we have as strong of a Trump supporting base here in New York. They are definitely there, make no question about it. You know, there's no doubt about it that people like, I don't know, Nick Langworthy, you know, some out in Western New York, upstate more, I think you'll find more, you know, Elise Stefanik is, you know, all about Trump. Down here in the city, Nicole Malliotakis, the one Republican member of the congressional delegation from New York City, she went from being lukewarm pro-Trump to being vociferously pro-Trump because that's what the politics of the district required. But overall, I don't think New York is that different from anywhere else. I think that you have a core of people who are very strongly pro-Trump within the Republican Party. However, I don't think that they are a majority. They're not a majority in New York, and they're not a majority anywhere else. He's got a very strong following within the Republican Party, but you start adding in the independents, you start voting in, you know, you start adding in party switchers, potentially, you know, sort of conservative Democrats and so forth. And I think he starts to fall below 50%. That's been the problem that he needed to face in 2020 and could not solve. And I think it's the problem he has this year as well.
Okay, let's move on to talk about the New York State budget now. There was an interesting door left open, at least to my ears, when there was a suggestion that maybe a budget deal could be announced before April 1st. And it's important to note that that's Easter weekend, so the deadline is a little fungible, it seems, even if the entire budget is not hammered out by then. So it sounded to me like we're probably looking at a late budget. Did it sound the same way to you?
No, what I heard was they're dealing with a lot of different, their eyes on the calendar. Or to the extent that we in the media ask about it, they're very aware of the calendar. I think the calendar that they're more concerned about is not the religious calendar, but the political calendar. All 212 members of the legislature are up for election this year. The early voting, I believe, starts in about 90 days, almost exactly 90 days.
Yikes.
From now. And they do not. Want to be up in Albany, you know, talking about conservation measures or energy efficiency, building and zoning codes or anything else. They want to be in their districts, knocking on doors and campaigning. And so for that reason alone, I think it will be a timely budget. It might be on this or that side of Easter or April 1st, whatever the deadline is. But I don't think it's going to go much further than that because they all want to get back into their districts.
What was your take on the One House budget bills? And, you know, it's a bit of deja vu from last year. We had the governor's proposals and now we have a legislative idea about how to handle housing this year. Do you see any other big dividing lines?
Well, I'd say we have a half of a legislative idea about how to handle housing,
right?
Because in the One House bills, the assembly came up with nothing, meaning they're still negotiating. They're still trying to, I believe, the hindrance in that case or the sticking point was they don't have the unions on board yet. So until you get both houses a little further down the road with their negotiations internally, I don't think we have a housing deal. So I mean, this is not good. This is not good. One of the issues that also was not in either House budget, which I think is interesting and telling, is mayoral control of the schools, which is a big deal in New York City. It's the largest school system by far in the whole country, and close to 1 million kids. And we don't know who's going to be in charge of the system. The mayor's sole control of the system, or overwhelming control of the system, is supposed to sunset this year. He's got to get some kind of an extension. What the legislature has signaled is that they're not going to make it part of the budget, which is what the governor wanted. They're not going to make it part of that must pass legislation, which means they want to negotiate with the mayor. I don't know what the points of disagreement or negotiation will be, but what they're saying is, we're not going to make this must pass. We're not going to get it done in this first round. We're not going to do it by April 1st. That could change, of course, but as of right now, where that negotiation is probably not very pleasing to the folks at City Hall.
Kathy Hochul has a different style in dealing with the mayor of New York than Andrew Cuomo did. And I think, to say the least, Mayor Adams is different from the way Bill de Blasio was. But how do you see city and state interacting right now? I mean, we had this subway safety plan that was announced. That raised some eyebrows, obviously. What's the state of play between the two of them?
You know, I don't think it's as friendly as both of them say. You know, when mm-hmm. that subway safety plan was announced, the mayor was not standing next to the governor. And when asked about it, the governor spent about 5 minutes saying that it's no big deal that the mayor was not there. If she'd spent 30 seconds instead of 5 minutes, it would have been a little more persuasive. Look, there's an institutional tension between the mayor and the governor. It goes back many, many decades. It's almost inevitable. It's almost baked into the system, because the mayor has in some ways, the bigger pulpit. They're right here in the media capital, and most people here think that they are in charge of almost everything. That always frustrates the governors, since they, in fact, have more power and certainly a lot more in the way of resources to wield in a bigger area of responsibility, both politically and constitutionally, frankly. It's the United States of America, right? The cities are not even mentioned. So I think that the relationship between the mayor and the governor is probably not as warm and friendly as they would like to portray. Nothing could have been worse than the toxic relationship between de Blasio and Cuomo. This is far better than that, but it's not perfectly smooth by any means. In fact, that subway safety plan, there was some good reporting that suggested that the mayor was informed of it the night before it happened. That's not what you do with an ally.
Yeah. So let me wrap up by asking about that Andrew Cuomo op-ed saying congestion pricing, after all, is not the best idea. What did you make of that?
Andrew Cuomo, let's take him at his word, first of all. If substantively he thinks that there may be some problems, okay, fine. He's not the first suburbanite to complain that they may have to pay.
He wants to get on that exception list.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. I think the main thing driving Andrew Cuomo these days is a quest for relevance, right? He'd love it if we all begged him to return in some form or fashion to either run for office or take a high-level appointment or something like that. I don't know that that's in the cards. I don't know if speaking out in this way on this issue is going to get that particular job done. He signed it into law. He advocated for it. I mean, he's really in no position now to sort of say, how could I have been so mistaken? Please, let's continue having an average vehicle speed in lower Manhattan of what, 4.5 miles an hour, something like that, 4.9 miles an hour. It was a decade long fight to get congestion pricing. And I think the horse is out the barn. I mean, to mix metaphors, I think that bus is rolling, and it doesn't matter who throws himself in front of it. Not even Andrew Cuomo can stop it at this point.
Errol Lewis, you can watch The Big Deal on Spectrum News. It's always great having you on our podcast, Errol. You're the best. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be with you.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.